Legal Professor Jeremy Gans teaches at Melbourne University's Law School. An accomplished author, he conducts research across all aspects of the criminal justice system, including the highly unconventional. One of Jeremy's books details a case of juror misconduct involving the use of a Ouija board. Another details the history of the law's treatment of animals. We're talking guilty pigs, reasonable cows, and trespassing bees. Join Jeremy and I for this episode of Unfiltered as we dive into some of the weird and wonderful aspects of the criminal justice system. Jeremy, I always tense up at the thought of reading books about the law because I find legal jargon really hard to digest. But you write more like a storyteller.
Yeah, look, I got into criminal law in part because it struck me as a bit of the law that isn't just about talking to other lawyers. Everyone's interested in criminal law. And so back when I was a student, I was thinking, if I'm at a party, could I talk about what I'm doing my PhD on or researching? And I ended up choosing criminal law because I thought that was something I could talk about. Now that I'm a bit at the other end of my career, I've got a bit tired of publishing articles in academic journals because, again, it's the same thing. You're mostly talking to other academics and I want to talk to more people. So I've got into blogging and I got into Twitter, and that's affected how I write. And so now I tend to write more for a wider audience.
I really wanted to start on the Ouija board jurors case. It focuses on a specific case of juror misconduct that involved the use of a Ouija board. For those that don't know, Jeremy, what is a Ouija board and how does it operate?
A Ouija board can mean a number of things, but usually it means a piece of cardboard and some equipment marketed by a gaming company. So it was invented at the start of the 20th century and was marketed to people who are interested in spiritual things. And it's just a board with a bunch of letters of the alphabet, numbers, and a couple of words like hello and goodbye. And then there's a device, a piece of metal or plastic or something that you can use to put over a particular letter and you can read that letter. The key thing about this device is if you give it a push, it moves. And the way the board works is everyone puts their finger on the device and then it feels to everyone as if it's just moving on its own and it moves from letter to letter. Now, no one thinks it's actually moving entirely on its own, but the question is it moving because everyone's just pushing it in a particular direction, even if they don't feel it that way? Or is it moving because some supernatural force, a ghost or someone, is actually causing it to move about? That's the fun and also the pointy bit of the game. In fact, their tagline is it a game or is it real? Because people who use them sit there wondering about that.
And when would you say was the height of Ouija board popularity? When was it trending?
Late in the 19th century and early in the 20th. It's waxed and waned. So there was a time in the 19th century where everyone was into spiritualism. Even Abraham Lincoln was trying to hold seances. And then there were times like after World War I where people had suffered a lot of loss and were trying to deal with it. And spiritualism came in at that point too. It's a bit of a fad. It got covered in the media as in the same way, you know, the internet or TikTok or yo-yos or whatever are covered in the media today. People would get into it and then it would fade away a bit. Nowadays, for most people, it's just a thing weird people do. And it's a plot point in horror movies where the idea is you shouldn't do this sort of thing. You might cause trouble for your family by attracting supernatural attention.
Yes, open a portal that you won't be able to close. That's at least my understanding of it. And I think, as you said, I'm influenced by seeing it depicted in Hollywood movies, for example. What I think we need to do now is connect Ouija boards to juries. What can you tell me about the way Ouija boards operate like juries?
They're not really like a jury. They can sometimes operate a bit like one aspect of the court process, which is questioning a witness. So in court, a person comes in the courtroom, you ask them a series of questions. There's a bit of a ritual about it. They have to say an oath and everyone takes turns questioning them and then everyone writes down the answers and they ponder what they mean. And Ouija boards operate a little bit like that as well, but without the oath. There's a different sort of ritual where you all put your fingers on the device and push it around and perhaps there's other rituals associated with it. But it's the same thing in the sense that you're questioning someone and you do a Ouija board by asking a question into the ether and then waiting for the answer to appear through the board.
And my understanding, at least from what I read, is that it operates on the basis of consensus as well.
Ah, good point. Sorry, I was wondering what you were getting at about the jury. You're right. You can't actually really do a Ouija board on your own. If you put a finger on the piece of plastic on your own and it moves about, you kind of know you're the one who's doing it. But if there's more than one person, and especially when there's lots of people, then the feeling really is that it feels like it's moving on its own rather than any of you individually doing it. And indeed, it's entirely possible that even without ghosts being involved, it's being moved without anyone being aware that they're the one doing the pushing. And yes, it might spell out letters, but it's people's subconscious which is pushing it towards particular letters rather than anyone consciously manipulating the board.
Now, just a kind of unrelated question about juries. I've always asked, is it why are juries considered to be reliable in determining the guilt or innocence of criminal defendants? Can you explain that from a law perspective?
Sure. I mean, juries don't exist because they're reliable. They exist for other reasons. They exist because no one can think of a method of sorting out truth and falsehood than using a jury. And the reason for that is the alternative is using professionals like judges. And the problem with professionals like judges is they make the same decisions or similar decisions repeatedly for years, and they end up just representing the system. They get hardened. They start to feel, I've seen all this before. I know how this is going to turn out. They bring in their own particular biases and they just build over time. And so a jury is a way of not having a system. It's called the jury system, but really it's the opposite of a system. 12 people are brought in. Often, most of them have no prior experience with the criminal justice system and never have any further experience. They're just once. And so they can get things wrong, but what they won't do is get things wrong because they're old hands. They're newbies to the system, and that's their major benefit. Why would you do things that way, given you're trying to work out the truth and these are just 12 people? The other bit of the magic of a jury is that there are 12 of them. So, yeah, you or me, we could easily get things wrong even if we're first-timers in the system. But the hope is that with 12 people, these aren't 12 people just individually deciding. They're required to talk and debate. And the hope, but that's all it is that if 12 people debate long enough, they will get closer to the truth than any person individually can do.
And it also kind of reminds me that it's a way for the law to represent the views of the public in some way, shape, or form with a congregation of a small amount of randomly chosen people.
I mean, that's the other justification for jurors. Originally, they were just locals from the village or whatever it was where a trial was being held. They actually didn't represent the public. They represented the village. They knew everyone and would make a call that way. That's not the approach now. There are suggestions, of course, that they represent the community in a way that judges don't. But there are a lot of people who disagree with that and say jurors aren't all that representative. A lot of people aren't eligible for jury duty. A lot of people who are eligible get out of it for all sorts of reasons. So it's not entirely clear they represent the public. They tend to be pretty old, for instance. I would agree, though, they're better at representing the public than judges are. Judges are very unusual people.
Who also tend to be very old.
Yes, oh, even older than jurors, in fact.
Let's move on to the case in question there, the Ouija board case. Okay, so it's a very high-profile case that happened in the UK back in 1994. A man by the name of Stephen Young was convicted of murdering Harry and Nicola Fuller. But the night before the jury was to deliver their verdict, four members of the jury supposedly used a Ouija board to contact one of the deceased victims. Now, this took place in a room in the hotel they were all staying at. And the following day, the jury found Stephen Young guilty of double homicide. The story doesn't stop there, though. 4 weeks later, a guy called Adrian, who was the youngest member of that particular jury, sent a handwritten letter to the Crown Court where he blew the whistle, so to speak, on the events that occurred on the night preceding the jury's verdict, calling the case a miscarriage of justice. And for the record, Adrian was not involved in the seance in question. Did I get anything wrong or miss anything important?
No, you got everything right. And I think it's really interesting that you got it all right, because a lot of reporting about this case, especially more recent reporting, gets lots of it wrong. They say that the Ouija board was used in the jury room when it was in a hotel room, and it was used by all 12 when it, as you correctly said, it was just four of them who used it.
Adrian sends the letter. This is the point where the case starts getting murky. What happens next?
What happens is the letter gets sent to the Crown Court. It seems like Adrian was also put in touch with Stephen Young's defence team in this case. So they also knew about it. And so the next thing that happened was an appeal by Stephen Young. He appealed against his conviction, which everyone is allowed to do, but he wasn't appealing saying, I'm innocent, or the trial judge did something wrong. He did all that much later. He said, I need a new trial because the jury did the wrong thing. Effectively, I didn't have a trial at all. I was tried by Ouija board. It's at this point that I heard of the case. I happened to be backpacking in England at the time and read about it in a tabloid. My first response is I didn't believe it had happened. I thought it was just made up, and was quite surprised a year later when I got back to Australia and there it was in the law reports with a judgment on this case. And the judgment found that what Adrian said was true. A Ouija board had been used, or a form of a Ouija board had been used by the jurors in the hotel room. And the Court of Appeal said that Stephen Young needed to be retried by a new jury, one who didn't use a Ouija board.
And for the record, he was found guilty again. And there was a lot of evidence that pointed to him. I think it's important to note that as well. Now, the court made a decision. Where does the problem lie in the court's decision to permit a retrial based on Young's argument?
Well, they encountered a couple of problems. One is jury deliberations are meant to be secret. And so an immediate question they had to work out is, are we even allowed to know about this? I mean, they'd all read about it in the news of the world, but is the court allowed to know about this, or are they meant to respect the secrecy of the jury room? So that was the first problem. The second problem is they had to find out the truth of what was going on, which meant they actually had to talk to some of the jurors, and that itself, they couldn't just rely on Adrian and his letter. They needed to talk to some of them. So that's a fairly tense process to go through. The jurors had to be warned that they might be incriminating themselves because it's illegal for them to do some things in their deliberations. But in the end, it just established that Adrian's story was, for the most part, true. It's worth noting that they didn't use an actual board like the one that's now marketed by Hasbro. They used a makeshift board, which was literally just some pieces of paper and a wine glass that they turned upside down and used as that bit of plastic to push around. So this was not a planned thing. They all got drunk and went off to a room and did it. But on the other hand, they also discovered some things that worried them. The prosecutors said, this is just juries having fun. They're just playing a game. That shouldn't be a problem here. But the court discovered that it didn't feel that much like a game because some of them were crying as they listened to the answers from this Ouija board. And, of course, they also established that the questions asked, and they were directed to Harry Fuller, one of the two murder victims, were things like, did Stephen Young kill you? To which Harry Fuller, via the Ouija board, answered yes. So that combination left the court worried enough that they felt this is the jury not reaching a verdict by the evidence and by looking at the trial, but reaching it for some other reason. They were worried enough about it. They called it a material irregularity, and that's why they ordered the new trial.
I know reading the book, you give other examples. Like, what's the difference between what they did and, say, a juror who consults their God for divine guidance, or jurors who are curious about their defendant's star sign? And, you know, these days, if you get the time, date and place of a person's birth, you can create their whole astrological map online. You can psychoanalyze them.
Yeah, I talk about a case, which you only learn about via really the newspaper, of a juror, again in England, asking for that information, and they said they wanted to work out a star sign. I think it was actually for the victim in that case. It was a dispute about self-defense. And that juror was then surprised to be thrown off the jury for even asking that question. To be fair, jurors are not meant to be experts. They're not meant to be legal analysts. Some of them will believe in astrology, and they're not booted out of a jury because they believe in astrology. But for whatever reason, he was booted out because they thought he was, instead of deciding via the evidence, he was going to decide via astrology. The modern analogue, the much more contemporary analogue, which the Ouija board case kind of gave a hint of what was to come, is people looking up things on the internet and deciding a case based on what they read on the internet rather than what they see in the courtroom. And that causes courts all sorts of worries these days. On the other hand, jurors are expected to bring in all sorts of personal information into the jury room. So if they've been, say, a victim of a crime, they will bring their experience of being a victim of a crime into a jury room, and everyone agrees that's fine. So drawing the line between reading something on the internet, personal experiences, playing a game in a hotel room, praying to a god, that's a pretty hard set of lines to draw.
There's a part in your book where you say, and this is a direct quote, Stephen Young's appeal could have been much more easily resolved if the court had accepted that the four jurors really did speak with Harry Fuller's ghost. I'm struggling until now to wrap my head around this. I don't get it. How? Why? What?
Well, I don't believe in Ouija boards myself, but if the court accepted that Ouija boards worked and they were a way of talking to the dead or even the living, because the jury also talked to someone's grandma who was alive while they were in that hotel room. If you can talk to other people, if they accepted that, then this would have been an easy case because jurors just aren't allowed to talk to other people. They're certainly not allowed to talk to material witnesses in a case. All those people are only allowed to talk to them if they come into court, swear their oath and so on. Otherwise, it's all just hearsay evidence. So interesting as it would be for all of us to know what Harry Fuller actually saw in that case, because as you said quite rightly, there's a lot of evidence pointing to Stephen Young, but it's not an open and shut case. There's some complications in the case. Harry Fuller may well know, and Nicola Fuller even more likely could know if they were able to talk today what happened in this case. So our instincts are, let's get to the truth. But it would have been an easy case for the court because this is the wrong way to get to the truth. You're not allowed to talk to people unless they come and swear an oath and are liable to be prosecuted for perjury. And Harry and Nicola did none of that, even if Ouija boards are true. But of course, the problem is the court didn't think Ouija boards are true. By then, they were over the whole spiritualism thing. So they had a quandary. What's wrong with a jury pretending or thinking it's talked to Harry Fuller? That's a harder question than what's wrong with the jury actually talking to Harry Fuller.
What actually happened to the four jurors involved?
Nothing, as far as I know. They weren't prosecuted. They probably just read about it in the newspaper like everyone else up until that point where a sheriff came to talk to them, and then they heard about the results afterwards, again in the newspaper. None of them ever spoken about it. I suspect they're all pretty grumpy at Adrian, the one who went to the media and told on them. So I doubt there was a happy get-together or anything like that, but otherwise nothing happened to those four. That being said, I do, through my own research, have a suspicion that this wasn't the end of things for that jury in one sense, which is I think that this trial would have stuck with them in the long run. I say that for two reasons. One, which is what probably my motivation for writing the book, is they're constantly put up as an example of stupid bad jurors. And I think that would weigh on them a lot.
And drunken, right?
Drunken, wasting money, all of that sort of thing. Jurors are no longer sent to hotel rooms these days. They're sent home. And sometimes this case is put up as one example of why that happens. So they've got a lot of responsibility put on them. This isn't uncommon, by the way. Jurors are routinely sort of pilloried in the media as stupid in various ways. They ask questions of a judge that everyone thinks are dumb. Or if they look up the internet or anything like that, they get attacked all the time. This one probably gets attacked more than most jurors. So that's one way this case lives on for them. But there's another way I think this case lives on, and this is where I ended up in the book. I was always puzzled why they did this, why they were crying, and the court was worried about why they were crying. Did they actually take this seriously? And I decided after a long look at the case that they had to hear that actually I think the reason this case would have stuck with them is for another reason altogether. It was a horrible case to be a juror in. It had some truly horrific evidence in it. And in fact, it was the very sort of evidence that would probably make you think about what it would be like to talk to a dead person. So this is a very dark bit of the book and just a warning to your listeners. They had to listen to a tape recording from Harry and Nicola's phone. And it actually showed part of the crime happening. It showed Nicola, they could hear Nicola Fuller being shot. They could hear the killer or killers. So this is why they had to listen to it. They were literally counting footsteps to work out how many killers there were. They had to listen to this tape. Now, that's bad enough, but there was a really terrible bit of the tape. The reason the tape exists is Nicola Fuller had rung the emergency line in the UK, 999, and she'd been shot in the face when she rang and wasn't able to talk. And so the really sad bit of this case, and it makes me, I've never heard the tape, but it makes me just devastated even relaying it, is that the operator didn't know who they were talking to and thought they were talking to a child. And they said, could you put your mummy on the line? That's the last words Nicola Fuller heard before she was killed by Stephen Young or whoever the killer was. Now, the jury had to listen to that. I feel terrible just describing it. The jury had to listen to that tape repeatedly. And I did find a documentary that was done about jurors and how stressful they find their work. And one of the jurors wasn't a jury from the trial where the Ouija board was used. It was from the retrial 6 months later, where a new jury reconvicted Stephen Young. And that juror, all he could talk about was that tape he had heard. And the documentary was made 3 years later. He was still in tears talking about it 3 years later. He was by far the most devastated of all the jurors that this documentary spoke to, even though some of them heard much more gruesome cases than this one. It was just really hard evidence to listen to. And I think that's the answer, to the very sad answer to what otherwise is often thought of as a funny case, which is that I think there's the jury may well have used a Ouija board in part because they were contemplating what Nicola Fuller was trying to say to the 999 people. And I have almost no doubt that they were in tears, not because of what Harry Fuller was supposedly saying to them, but because of that context, what they were thinking about in that case. If they were drunk, they were not happy drunk, is my best guess in this case. It's certainly a lesson on why you should hesitate in calling even the most ridiculous-sounding juries stupid. They have a very hard job, and I think we've got to be slow to judge them.
That's what I got at the end of your book. What kind of coping mechanisms do you expect people to employ when they're faced with such horrific crimes for the first time in their lives?
Absolutely, and in fact, around the time of this case, the court started to realise this was a genuine problem. Not in this case, mind you, they totally missed it here, but in other much more horrific cases about gruesome killings and the like. And they've started providing those services. And jurors are able to go to someone for help if they're struggling with their work, and they're provided with counselling and the like. And the trial is now managed in a slightly different way to try and ameliorate some of this for jurors. But I do think that not all the lessons have been drawn. So, for example, today jurors are routinely told, you are not allowed to talk about this case with anyone. Don't talk to your spouse. Don't talk to your friends and the like. And I think that's too harsh. I think you need to give jurors an outlet and take the risk that they will hear something that they might not be supposed to hear from their spouse or whatever. The alternative, just keeping to themselves, bottling it all in until well after the trial or whatever, I think is too harsh. And in fact, that juror in that documentary, he spoke about how his spouse struggled with his mood swings and all of that after the trial. Telling jurors to shut up and don't talk strikes me as, while I understand the impulse, strikes me as the wrong approach.
Unfiltered will be back shortly. Thank you for supporting us by listening to this episode's sponsors. Thank you for listening to this episode's ads. By supporting our sponsors, you support Unfiltered to continue to deliver quality content. I think you can get lessons on life, where we're at as a society, what we believe in, what we don't, and how the law interprets that.
Yeah, no, and that's very much my thinking. I mean, that's why I'm interested in the law, to be honest, is those kind of broader lessons. So, I mean, the other book you mentioned that Casey Barnett and I wrote, Guilty Pigs, it's on animal law and how the law deals with animals. But initially, both of us were interested in just explaining the law full stop, but also explaining how the law really poses a lot of very human quandaries and problems. And so we thought talking about how the law applies to animals was a way to talk about how the law affects all of us.
See, to me, it was the first time I'd heard about the concept of animal law, and I realised like I had no base, I have no idea what it even meant. Where do we even begin? Perhaps we can take it way back to some of the earliest documented cases of animal law. What can you tell me about that?
Yeah, so it's partly a history book. We look to how animals are dealt with thousands of years ago and how animals are dealt with in the Bible. And there is no animal law. There are just lots and lots of animal laws. that vary over time and over societies and over different parts of the legal system. So Katie, for instance, found that Ireland has a whole body of law about bees, and it's a massive set of rules about how to manage bees in society. If bees are coming into your property, what does that mean? If your bees go to someone else's property, what does that mean? If your hive moves and joins with another one, what does that mean? And so just in that little area, an area never even occurred to me there'd be legal rules at all. There are like hundreds of rules trying to manage how bees interact with people. You can't give orders to bees, although some people have tried, but you can give orders to people about what they do about these things. The other history bit is actually, it's where the title comes from, Guilty Pigs. It was about some periods in medieval Europe where they tried to apply the law directly to animals of various sorts. So if a pig killed a child, the pig would be put on trial and given the semblance of a trial. Not much of a trial, as you can imagine, because the pig couldn't participate much. But sadly enough, at that time, nor could human criminal defendants. They just had to receive their fate. And there were even civil suits where if your local village was being beset by weevils or whatever, you would go to the local church and sue the weevils. The goal here was to actually get the church to declare that it was okay to kill the weevils and that the weevils were not doing God's work. But it would be a legal case. The weevils would be given a lawyer who would make all sorts of very technical objections to the suit, and they would try and deal with things. In each of these cases, what both of these societies were trying to do was to puzzle over a conflict they had in their head between the fact that the animals were the work of God, but at the same time, the animals were doing things that seemed ungodly, and they were trying to reconcile those two things. These days, we don't bring God into it, but we still spend a lot of time trying to reconcile how we should be dealing with animals. Should we be dealing with them as property that humans own, as part of the environment that needs protection as some sort of environmental thing, or the way many of us think of at least some animals, as sentient beings, which have their own capacities, feelings, and where it's wrong in and of itself for them, say, to suffer. How do we reconcile that feeling with the fact that you can still go down to the local supermarket and buy meat from those very animals?
Yeah, because you can still cage animals for meat, fur, and fun and kill them. Are corporations held to the same level of responsibility as individuals in this regard?
Well, yeah, I teach corporate criminal justice as one of the things I teach, and there's actually a big mystery and question about whether you can treat corporations, which aren't human beings, the same way you treat human beings. We do our best to, because we want corporations to follow the same rules that humans do. But at times it's a bit of a puzzle how we're doing it. We can't send them to prison. They can't be put on a witness stand. So how do we deal with them? So that's a sort of modern analog to the issue of how do you deal with pigs back in the past.
This predicament of how do we treat animals under the law? Are they property? Are they treated as objects? Are they our equals? Is there an animal hierarchy under the law?
There's no single hierarchy, but every time you go and read an act of parliament that talks about animals and provides for rules about them or protections for them, the first thing I always do when I read one of those acts is go and look up the definition section to work out what they mean by an animal. And there is a hierarchy, and it's a hierarchy that's basically based on their similarity to us. So
chimpanzees.
Yeah, well, I mean, there aren't a lot of laws specifically in Australia about chimpanzees, although the proposals to give animals rights like humans is mostly about the great apes. But when you look at the definition of animal, it's the ones who are always covered are the mammals, like us, and the ones who are least likely to be covered are invertebrates, so octopuses or something like that, because they're the least like us in an evolutionary sense. Our definition of animal, and of course we're animals, revolves around us. So there is a movement these days, for example, in the case of octopuses, which we cover in the final chapter of the book. They're super intelligent and really interesting because they are, I mean, most of the other animals we regard as intelligent, like apes and dolphins or whatever, or whales, they're mammals, right? Which means that they have a common ancestor who is probably, we would also regard as intelligent. Octopuses, their common ancestor with us is a tiny little worm or slug or something from half a billion years ago. And yet they develop their own intelligence in a different pathway to us. They live radically different lives to us. They only live 6 months. They die after reproducing. Their brain is distributed throughout their body. They're very different to us in every way we could possibly imagine. And yet they act in ways that we associate with intelligence. If they get hurt by something, they stay away from it next time. They seem to be playful. They are clever in the way they can escape. And all of that has meant that there's been a change the last 50 years or so from regarding octopuses as food or scary to regarding octopuses as actually deserving the same kind of protection we give, say, to our closest pets, cats and dogs. The idea that it's wrong to eat them, that's wrong to experiment, and that we have a different obligation to them.
I grew up on the coast in Perth, Western Australia. And over the course of my childhood, a number of fatal shark attacks occurred along the Western Australian coastline. Then I think it was in 2014, after a spate of fatal shark attacks on that coastline, the Western Australian government actually introduced a 13-week shark culling program where they put baited drum lines along the beaches to trap sharks and shoot and kill any sharks that measured over 3 metres in length. And so in that 13-week period, 68 sharks were shot dead. Are you familiar with this?
Not that specific, but I'm very familiar with the bait that comes up every time there's a shark attack or whatever.
I remember at the time, and even still now, it divides public opinion. It really does. And for me personally, I was infuriated and devastated by the idea of humans thinking we have the right to enforce like sanctions on an entire shark population's ability to move freely in the waters and then think that we can annihilate any shark that we perceive as a threat due to a series of very unfortunate human deaths that occurred in shark territory because it's the ocean is where they live. So for me, it's saying it out loud, it sounds like US foreign policy. But what I wanted to talk to you about is how we can understand the Western Australian government's decision from the lens of criminal law and animal law and human laws. Are we protecting animals or are we protecting human rights to swim freely in our waters?
We're trying to protect both in conflicting ways. My co-author, Katie Barnett, when she was doing the chapter on medieval trials and putting pigs on trial, she actually found a more recent study by psychologists where they had asked people their opinions on when sharks should be killed. And they gave them a number of different scenarios. And people were angrier or more willing to kill sharks, is probably the fair way to say it, if the shark had killed what people would regard as an innocent person, say a child. But on the other hand, if the shark had killed, and one example that the researchers gave was a criminal, some criminal who ran into the water or something, people said, let the shark go on. These things happen. What it shows up is that we are not just judging sharks as animals. We are applying all of our values to them. And you get all those debates when sharks kill someone about whether whose fault was that? Was it the shark's and it's just its own nature? Was it just doing something natural? Was it a deviant shark? And then was it the person's fault? What were they doing in the water? Maybe they shouldn't have been swimming that location. And then you get things like guilt by association. Do we just kill the shark that did the killing? Or do we kill all the shark's family or all the other sharks in the pod or whatever it is as well? And why are we doing that? So you get all of those debates. There's not a lot of law, mind you, on sharks, but there is a lot of similar and much more difficult and wide-ranging law on when dogs kill people. So that's the most common animal death, or one of the most common animal deaths in the world, where dogs kill someone, often a child or something like that. What do we do in that situation? And I was really interested to see, and this is part of what drew me into this area, that the way we let courts decide whether the dog should be killed, put down, destroyed, involves a lot of the outs that we give to humans. So there's an exception if the dog was provoked. There's an exception if the human who the dog bit, say, was on the dog's property, a trespasser on their property. And so we do have outs for dogs as well that are similar to the outs we provide to humans. And then there are other outs. There is a case in the ACT where the judge decided that one of the dogs was the real culprit and had led the other dog astray. And so there was a willingness to destroy one dog and not the other on the basis of these judgment calls that we really would apply to humans in all sorts of ways.
I'm just trying to understand, how is the dog punished? Is it through capital punishment?
So the method today is dogs aren't put on trial. Their owners are put on trial. So if a dog bites someone or even just runs up to someone in an aggressive way that scares someone, the owner can be charged and is often charged with an offence. So they say, I'm not guilty. And sometimes they'll say, because it's not their fault, the dog got away from them in a way they couldn't have stopped. Some third party intervened and caused the dog to get angry. So they'll try and defend themselves. But as well, they can also say, even though I did all the wrong things, the dog did the right thing. So they can also argue that as a defence. And the court will just resolve whether that person is guilty of being the owner of a bad dog. In any case, if the owner is convicted, you move over to sentencing. And it's the sentencing of the owner, not of the dog. So the owner could get sent to jail, or they could get fined, or they could be given an order they're not allowed to own dogs anymore. And of course, that order impinges on the dog, who now no longer has an owner. But the sentencing judge in most jurisdictions can do one more thing, which is they can say, and I order that the dog be destroyed, killed. And that's part of the punishment of the owner. Courts will say they're not doing this to make the owner feel bad. They're doing this because they're trying to stop future offences. They're worried that if they don't destroy the dog, the owner will continue to be the owner of a bad dog and the dog will hurt someone else. So it's not punishment in the sense of desert. It's punishment in the sense of control. In the book, we open the book with a case which went all the way to the High Court of Australia, Australia's top court, where this had happened. A dog had bitten someone. The owner got prosecuted. The owner agreed to plead guilty on the basis that the prosecutor said, we won't ask the judge to destroy the dog. And so that's what happened. They didn't ask the judge to destroy the dog. The judge was really upset and said, he wanted to imprison the owner. He clearly would have destroyed the dog if he did. It was a dog named Izzy, but he wasn't asked by the prosecutor, so he couldn't do it. But what happened next? The local council said, now we're going to destroy the dog because they're allowed to destroy any dog where the owner has been convicted of an offence about that dog. So they said they were going to destroy the dog. They had their own little trial where the victims came forward and the judgment was made. And that dog was going to be destroyed, but in the end, the owner, appealed all the way up to the High Court of Australia, and the High Court saved the dog's life. So there's an instance that's where we open the book of multiple different bits of the law coming together and a dog's life being saved at the end of the day. Specifically, they said that if the local council wants to destroy the dog, they need to get independent people in to make the judgment. They can't bring in the same people who prosecuted the owner in the first place. That was the ruling that saved Izzy's life. We tracked down Izzy. Izzy is now alive and well, as far as we know, but had been moved out of Victoria up to Queensland because that's where they could find someone willing to care for a dog who had that stain on its record.
Within the species of dogs, there are certain dogs that we look at and consider more dangerous. Whether they are or not is totally questionable. I tend to think they're not. Rottweilers, Dobermans, and the most famous, of course, the Pitbull.
That's right. And in my home state of Victoria, there was a horrible series of incidents where attacks happened and a child was killed. And so the government did try to ban some breeds, and notably Pitbull Terriers. But the attempt to ban totally failed. And it's because, although we're all familiar with dog breeds, I guess this is a slightly controversial thing to say, but it's a bit like human races. They're something we've made up a bit. There's a rough difference between different dogs, but there are a lot of similarities as well. So the courts kept running into a problem where they would think they found a pit bull, but the owner would say, that's not a pit bull, it's some other breed. And they would call in seven experts, and they'd all disagree about whether this was a pit bull or not, and became unworkable. They've had to back away from that attempt to ban by breed and recognised it, and this is the usual thing people say in this area, the major problem is owners. I don't know if it's just owners training the dogs badly or owners being attracted to certain breeds who are in turn not the best breeds to have around children or what, but it's too simplistic to say that the problem is the dog. The problem might be in part the dog and in part, perhaps in most part, the owner.
To finish, I thought it would be nice if you could perhaps share some insights you have on how animal law teaches us about human law currently.
Well, there have been a couple of recent ones about animal protesters. So these are people these are humans, protesting about the treatment of non-human animals but in farms and the like. And they're the subject of a lot of laws trying to stop them protesting. They sometimes try to use the law in their favour. And a case went to the High Court just recently about whether it's okay, it should be okay for them to sneak into people's properties and tape how they're dealing with animals. And they said, it's the only way we can protect the animals. We can't trust the humans. Everything happens behind closed doors. Let us tape. Now, the High Court said, no, you can't tape. The Parliament's allowed to ban private conversations, even when they involve animals. Take that up with Parliament. Don't take it up with us. But one of the judges, and he's the youngest judge on the High Court, James Edelman, he did a very lengthy judgment. He was very troubled by this case, and he was right on the line of what to do about it. But the thing that caught our eye, well, one thing that caught our eye, he referred throughout to animals as, when he's talking about rabbits or whatever it is, or whatever the animal people were trying to protect, he referred to them as non-human animals. And so what that underlines and the point he was making, and we did throughout our book, is we're animals, right? And when we talk about animal law, we're talking about the law of non-human animals. That's a simple enough little message, but it's a really good one to bring in. You've got to constantly remember what we are and what we're talking about when we're talking about animals. We're talking about us as well, and that we are drawing a distinction between humans and non-humans. Not always a defensible distinction, and one we have to keep thinking about.
Thanks for tuning in to this week's episode of Unfiltered with Jeremy Gans. You'll find the link to Jeremy's books in our show notes.